Okay, welcome everyone to the Savitri sessions on Infinite Conversations, where we are reading and discussing Sri Aurobindo's Savitri, a legend and a symbol, 24,000 lines of mantric poetry filled with yogic consciousness. We are resuming in Book Two, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto Eight. The world of falsehood, the mother of evil, and the sons of darkness. Between the worlds of life and mind, this title is very, very Vedic. These phrases come from the Veda, and so we'll begin after a meditation. And let's go in the order of Andrea, John Robert, Marco, Jeffrey, and then myself. Andrea, can you time a 3 to 5 minute meditation? Excellent. Thank you.
Book two, Canto eight, The World of Falsehood, The Mother of Evil, and the Sons of Darkness. Then could he see the hidden heart of night, the labor of its stark unconsciousness revealed the endless, terrible inane. A spiritless blank infinity was there, a nature that denied the eternal truth in the vain braggart freedom of its thought, hoped to abolish God and reign alone. There was no sovereign guest, no witnessed light. Unhelped, it would create its own bleak world. Its large blind eyes looked out on demon acts. Its deaf ears heard the untruth its dumb lips spoke. Its huge misguided fancy took vast shapes. Its mindless sentience quivered with fierce conceits, engendering a brute principle of life. Evil and pain begot a monstrous soul. The anarchs of the formless depths arose, great titan beings and demoniac powers, world egos wrecked with lust and thought and will, vast minds and lives without a spirit within, impatient architects of error's house, leaders of the cosmic ignorance and unrest, and sponsors of sorrow and mortality embodied the dark ideas of the abyss. A shadow substance into emptiness came. Dim forms were born in the unthinking void, and eddies met and made an adverse space in whose black folds being imagined hell. His eyes, piercing the triple-plated gloom, identified their sight with its blind stare. Accustomed to the unnatural dark, they saw unreality made real and conscious night.
A violent, fierce, and formidable world. An ancient womb of huge calamitous dreams, coiled like a larva in the obscurity that keeps it from the spear points of heaven's stars. It was the gate of a false infinite, an eternity of disastrous absolutes, an immense negation of spiritual things. All once self-luminous in the spirit's sphere turned now into their own dark contraries. Being collapsed into a pointless void that yet was a zero parent of the worlds. In conscience, swallowing up the cosmic mind produced a universe from its lethal sleep. Bliss into black coma fallen, insensible, coiled back to itself and God's eternal joy through a false, poignant figure of grief and pain, still dolorously nailed upon a cross, fixed in the soil of a dumb, insentient world, where birth was a pang and death an agony, lest all too soon should change again to bliss. Thought sat, a priestess of perversity, on her black tripod of the triune snake, reading by opposite signs the eternal script, a sorceress reversing life's god frame. In darkling aisles with evil eyes for lamps and fatal voices chanting from the apes, in strange, infernal, dim basilicas intoning the magic of the unholy word. The ominous, profound initiate performed the ritual of her mysteries. There, suffering was nature's daily food, alluring to the anguished heart and flesh. And torture was the formula of delight. Pain mimicked the celestial ecstasy.
There, good, a faithless gardener of God, watered with virtue the world's upas tree, and, careful of the outward word and act, engrafted his hypocrite blooms on native ill. All high things served their nether opposite. The forms of gods sustained a demon cult. Heaven's face became a mask and snare of hell. There in the heart of vain phenomenon, in an enormous action's writhen core, he saw a shape illimitable and vague, sitting on death who swallows all things born. A chill, fixed face with dire and motionless eyes, her dreadful trident in her shadowy hand outstretched, she pierced all creatures with one fate. When nothing was.
Do we want to stop and discuss between sections?
That would be a good idea. There were some very complex sentences just in this last section.
So does anybody know what an upas tree is?
I think I got this definition from John Robert. I have a fabled poisonous tree of Java. Did that come from you, John Robert? Yeah, thank you. John Robert looked it up once upon a time. So this is the mother of evil that comes in right at the end of this section. And the section is correlated with the world of falsehood and just the basic structure. Then the next section is really dealing with the mother of evil. And then the section after that, the sons of darkness. So it does follow the pattern of the title. And then the last section is quite long. And it's an evolutionary synthesis, actually, to emerge out of these realms. And this kind of comes from Sri Aurobindo, not kind of, I mean, it does. This figure, I don't know why I have this note in the column, but I have the vital Kali, the red Kali that's eating, stomping on heads and really destroying things. It could come in the shape of an orange-faced president. It can come in a lot of different forms. It can, and this is differentiated from the Maha Kali. He talks about a lot in Letters on Yoga, the difference between the red Kali and the golden white Kali, the Maha Kali, which is power. It's not this vital creature. I mean, this vital creature is pure power also, but it's coming with a very different aspiration.
So there is this thing, God's eternal joy through a false poignant figure of grief and pain. It looks like a parody of Christianity. Or is it actual? Is he actually talking about Christ? So it's somewhat, I don't know. If he's actually talking about Christianity, he could be in trouble for these words.
I think he picks up pieces from our actual history that represent these things. I mean, there's the God on the cross, right? Still in the, where was that?
Yeah, painfully nailed, dolorously nailed upon a cross, line 48 or something, 49.
The last bit of that sentence there, that line, lest all too soon should change again to bliss, was interesting because he seems to be inverting like the normal, like, way we would consider that event, you know, consider this world as being, so static and so difficult. And that it's just barely, he seems to be suggesting here that it's just barely containing an inner bliss that would otherwise be the permanent state. I don't know, that's, I hear where he's coming from there, but I think it's also from the, from the pain or from the world of falsehood or from like the, it can seem impenetrable. It can seem like that there's, like that suffering and pain is the core reality, and that God on the cross is representing something very essential and foundational about human experience.
Yeah, I noticed that line that you quoted there, Marco, every time I read this, it's like bliss is just kind of waiting to burst out. Unless it's really contained by this other, or by its opposite. Sure, Benno said that pain and suffering were bliss that were too intense for our frames to handle. But he also said when he broke his leg, he also said it was very difficult to convert that pain back into bliss. I mean, when he experienced it that way.
He broke his thigh bone in 1938, opening up access to him, actually. A lot came out of that. It was really interesting. But according to him, he was defending the mother against occult powers, and he lost awareness of the defense around his own physical being, and basically he was like, I think, intensely pacing on the floor of his room. I don't know if pacing is the right word, but walking, and he missed the, there was a tiger head pelt on the floor, and I think his foot caught it and he fell, and it actually fractured his thigh bone. And in 1938, he was 68. He was 60. 30, no. 68. He was 66.
So that happened 12 years before he left his body?
Yes. There's a 12-year cycle in there also, because it happened 12 years after 1926. Lots of 12s. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which happened 12 years after the beginning of the publication of Arya. Lots of 12s.
Shall I continue?
I have one other question. Does anybody know what the symbol of the black tripod of the triune snake is referring to?
The snake is, so going back up to line 45, bliss into black coma, fallen sensible, coiled back into itself. I think that this is the coiling down into the Muladhara, or going toward the inconscient, of the serpent energy, of the coiled serpent Shakti. So then kind of coming back to that metaphor, the black tripod, on her black tripod, I think that this is the triple world of the triple lower world, mind, life, body, but fallen into a darkness, and the triune snake being like coiled, the chakras, the snake being that energy that's in the Muladhara, literally the root vehicle. These chakras going up through the body represent their physical, vital, and mind chakras in the evolving world. So I sense that as the snake that's kind of the snake as a metaphor around the chakras of the lower world, like sitting on that tripod seat. That's always my sensing when he uses threes like that in this way. I don't know the specific definition of triune.
Well, it means of three, or like the Trinity is triune.
So, I mean, of course, we know tri, but what does that, the root word, yun, is it like union, triple union?
I wonder if it means three and one.
Three and one. Yeah, I think that's probably good.
I'm familiar with the word from the idea of a triune brain.
It says three and one in I just looked it up.
Yeah, good. Thanks, Jeffrey. Triune brain, is this
the triune brain?
Left brain, right brain?
No, it's reptilian brain, mammalian brain, and then neocortex.
Ah, great. That's the triune brain, reptilian, mammalian, and neocortex.
The three levels going up. Yeah.
Ah, good. Thank you. It's threes all the way up and all the way down. And those threes are all sitting on turtles.
And those are also associated with survival-based systems, limbic, emotional, social, emotional systems, and then cognitive, reflective systems. So roughly can correlate with maybe chakra centers, but not exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay. So from a chilled, fixed face with dire and motionless eyes, her dreadful trident in her shadowy hand outstretched, she pierced all creatures with one fate. I'll continue on to the next section. When nothing was save matter without soul, and a spiritless hollow was the heart of time, then life first touched the insensible abyss. Awaking the stark void to hope and grief, her pallid beam smote the unfathomed night, in which God hid himself from his own view. In all things she sought their slumbering mystic truth, the unspoken word that inspires unconscious forms. She groped in his deeps for an invisible law, fumbled in the dim subconscient for his mind, and strove to find a way for spirit to be. But from the night another answer came, A seed was in that nether matrix cast, a dumb, unprobed husk of perverted truth, a cell of insentient infinite. A monstrous birth prepared its cosmic form in nature's titan embryo, ignorance. Then, in a fatal and stupendous hour, something that sprang from the stark inconscient sleep, unwillingly begotten by the mute void, lifted its ominous head against the stars. Overshadowing Earth with its huge body of doom, it chilled the heavens with the menace of a face.
A nameless power, a shadowy will, arose immense and alien to our universe. In the inconceivable purpose, none can gauge a vast non-being robed itself with shape. The boundless nescience of the unconscious depths covered eternity with nothingness. A seeking mind replaced the seeing soul. Life grew into a huge and hungry death. The spirit's bliss was changed to cosmic pain. Assuring God's self-cowled neutrality, a mighty opposition conquered space. A sovereign ruling falsehood, death and grief, it pressed its fierce hegemony on the earth. Disharmonizing the original style of the architecture of her fate's design, it falsified the primal cosmic will, and bound to struggle and dread vicissitudes the long, slow process of the patient power. Implanting error in the stuff of things, it made an ignorance of the all-wise law. It baffled the sure touch of life's hid sense, kept dumb the intuitive guide in matter's sleep, deformed the insect's instinct and the brute's, disfigured man's thought-born humanity. A shadow fell across the simple ray. Obscured was the truth light in the cavern heart that burns unwitnessed in the altar crypt behind the still velamen's secrecy, companioning the godhead of the shrine. This was the dire antagonist, energy born, who mimes the eternal mother's mighty shape and mocks her luminous infinity with a gray, distorted silhouette in the night.
Arresting the passion of the climbing soul, she forced on life a slow and faltering pace. Her hands deflecting and retarding weight is laid upon the mystic evolution's curve. The torturous line of her deceiving mind, the gods see not, and man is impotent. Oppressing the God spark within the soul, she forces back to the beast the human fall. Yet in her formidable instinctive mind, she feels the one grow in the heart of time and sees the immortal shine through the human mold. Alarmed for her rule and full of fear and rage, she prowls around each light that gleams through the dark, casting its ray from the spirit's lonely tent, hoping to enter with fierce, stealthy tread and in the cradle, slay the divine child. Incalculable are her strength and ruse. Her touch is a fascination and a death. She kills her victim with his own delight. Even good, she makes a hook to drag to hell. For her, the world runs to its agony. Often the pilgrim on the eternal's road, ill-lit from clouds by the pale moon of mind, or in devious byways wandering alone, or lost in deserts where no path is seen, falls overpowered by her lion leap. A conquered captive under her dreadful paws. Intoxicated by a burning breath and amorous groan of a destroying mouth. Once a companion of the sacred fire, the mortal perishes. To God and light, an adversary governs heart and brain, a nature hostile to the mother force. The self of life yields up its instruments to Titan and demoniac agencies that aggrandize earth nature and disframe a cowled fifth columnist is now thought's guide. His subtle defeatist murmur slays the faith and lodged in the breast or whispering from outside. A lying inspiration fell and dark. A new order substitutes for the divine.
A silence falls upon the spirit's heights. From the veiled sanctuary, the god retires. Empty and cold is the chamber of the bride. The golden nimbus now is seen no more. No longer burns the white spiritual ray, and hushed forever is the secret voice. Then by the angel of the vigil tower, a name is struck from the recording book. A flame that sang in heaven sinks, quenched and mute. In ruin ends the epic of a soul. This is the tragedy of the inner death. When forfeited is a divine element, and only a mind and body live to die.
We maybe want to stop and talk.
Do you have any questions or comments, Jeffrey?
Velleman? Anyone?
I don't know. David Bowie used that word in his last album. I never looked it up. It
means membrane.
Membrane. Oh.
This sounds like a critique of nihilistic materialism and it's all of its consequences, you know, for an individual. soul or being. When nothing was save matter without soul, and a spiritless hollow was the heart of time, then life first touched the insensible abyss. And I don't know if there's more than that going on, because there's times where I think Sri Aurobindo's telling a kind of history, like a history of like a world history, the story of spirit unfolding on Earth and its present and its future. But sometimes it feels like it could be a cosmic history that's not particular to Earth, but is more of an abstract account, or more of a inner account. So I don't want to just make it into like an intellectual like argument that he's poetizing here. I think that there may be other layers of interpretation.
I mean, this is also the story of the fall, but not necessarily it, including, but certainly not limited to Christian mythology. But it's like, so if Christ is the immanent in Abrahamic religions, which not all Christianity interprets this way, au contraire, actually. But if Christ is the immanent, then this divine, these forces circling around the light of the divine child, the Veda puts this as the child seated within to be born. There's certainly lots in the language of mythical Christianity, certainly in mystic Christianity. But the difference, so the story of the fall here in the beginning of the section is knowledge putting on the mask of ignorance. It's bliss putting on the mask of suffering, life putting on the mask of death. The key difference, I would say, in the more common Christian mythos is the common Abrahamic mythos is blaming humans for the fall, specifically blaming woman for the fall, which to me just has always seemed quite awful, actually. And this is a lot more cosmic. This is kind of putting it in the realms of the gods before human came to maturity. Even in fact, we came to maturity within this mythic structure.
So I looked up Velamen. It says the thick, corky epidermis of aerial roots of an epiphytic orchid that absorbs water from the atmosphere.
Oh, it's those roots that hang out the top of the pot. the coating of those roots, that grayish. So
literally the covering of the roots.
Ah, the covering of aerial roots.
Yes.
Ah. Thank you, Jeffrey. I get so happy and nerdy about this stuff.
That's Merriam-Webster. But I felt like the word should have more to it, because it has such an interesting sense to it. You know, it's very Latin sounding, right?
It must have another meaning as well, because here there's nothing about roots. We're in a crypt or cavern. We're in these kind of stony places, and vela is related to the word veil.
Yes.
So I wonder if there's an occult meaning as well.
I wonder if there's an architectural meaning, like something to do with the architectural design of old cathedrals. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah.
When you were just sharing, Matteo, about Christianity, I was also struck by the, in the cradle, slay the divine child. And when Jesus was born, shortly after, that was the, you know, the quote-unquote dark forces were wow. after slaying. In fact, slayed all the children born, and he managed to escape in the cradle.
Yeah, and that mythos, they came after him. Herod,
yeah.
Yeah.
I also hear the echo here of Yeats's Second Coming, the rough beast. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born with this with what Sri Aurobindo calls a monstrous birth, prepared its cosmic form in nature's titan embryo, ignorance. And then in a fatal and stupendous hour, something that sprang from the stark inconscience, sleep, unwillingly begotten by the mute void, lifted its ominous head against the stars, overshadowing Earth with its huge body of doom. This is really dramatic language. And it chilled the heavens with the menace of a face. So what is the menace of a face? That one, that kind of struck with me.
Yeah, I think these powers actually are embodied, right? Somehow. Maybe not in a physical body, but as an entity. And so they have faces.
And this cowled fifth columnist is an interesting reference to
Spanish. I think it roots back to the Spanish Civil War, where they were literally, the fifth column was literally putting spies into the, I can't remember, the Republican army, the one that was against Franco. I don't quite remember.
You ready to go on? For terrible agencies the spirit allows, and there are subtle and enormous powers that shield themselves with the covering ignorance. Offspring of the gulfs, agents of the shadowy force, haters of light, intolerant of peace, aping to the thought, the shining friend and guide, opposing in the heart the eternal will. They veil the occult, uplifting harmonist. His wisdom's oracles are made our bonds. The doors of God they have locked with keys of creed, and shut out by the law his tireless grace. Along all nature's lines they have set their posts, and intercept the caravans of light. Wherever the gods act, they intervene. A yoke is laid upon the world's dim heart. Masked are its beats from the supernal bliss, and the closed peripheries of brilliant mind block the fine entries of celestial fire.
Always, the dark adventurers seem to win. Nature they fill with evil's institutes, turn into defeats the victories of truth, proclaim as falsehoods the eternal laws, and load the dice of doom with wizard lies. The world's shrines they have occupied, usurped its thrones. In scorn of the dwindling chances of the gods, they claim creation as their conquered fief and crown themselves the iron lords of time. Adepts of the illusion and the mask, the artificers of nature's fall and pain have built their altars of triumphant night in the clay temple of terrestrial life. In the vacant precincts of the sacred fire, in front of the reredos in the mystic rite, facing the dim velamen none can pierce, intones his solemn hymn, the mitred priest, invoking their dreadful presence in his breast. Attributing to them the awful name, he chants the syllables of the magic text and summons the unseen communion's act, while twixt the incense and the muttered prayer, all the fears of Baal with which the world is racked is mixed in the foaming chalice of man's heart and poured to them like a sacramental wine. Assuming names divine, they guide and rule. Opponents of the highest, they have come out of their world of soulless thought and power to serve by enmity the cosmic scheme. Night is their refuge and strategic base. Against the sword of flame, the luminous eye, bastioned, they live in massive forts of gloom, calm and secure in sunless privacy. No wandering ray of heaven can enter there. Armored, protected by their lethal masks, as in a studio of creative death, the giant sons of darkness sit and plan the drama of the earth, their tragic stage. I guess I'll go read the rest of this section. All who would raise the fallen world must come under the dangerous arches of their power. For even the radiant children of the gods, to darken their privilege is and dreadful rite. None can reach heaven who has not passed through hell.
That is such an amazing line, that last one. None can reach heaven who has not passed through hell. You can see it, you know, people are so attached to the light, they just want everything to be beautiful and it's not complete, you know. They have to enter the darkness to reach heaven.
I really like the line on the previous page, especially three lines. It's about three quarters of the way down. Opponents of the highest, they have come out of their world of a soulless thought and power to serve by enmity a cosmic scheme. It's kind of the encapsulation of Sri Aurobindo's theory of pain and suffering.
Evolution, yeah. The evolutionary necessity, the evolutionary function, not necessity, evolutionary function of pain and suffering. And these last lines are so part of all of our so many of our narratives. It's like the Darth Vader that didn't come back. He went in and got captured by that dark force. And then it's in so many of our stories, Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings, all the kind of our modern epics that have been turned into film epics contain a lot of elements here.
Yeah, I know the luminous eye actually means something different, but I couldn't help thinking of the Sauron eye in the film, The Lord of the Rings.
These images have affected me too. Like, yeah, I see that also.
And the dangerous arches of their power, I thought of the McDonald's arches.
Oh, that's
golden arches.
the golden arches that are deforesting the Amazon to raise beef. propping up dictators. Goodness. I suppose the word velamen lodged in these other lines made me think that it's some sort of architecture thing in an old cathedral. But yeah, I just have the word membrane written here also. Reredos, ornamental backdrop to an altar. Mitered is that shape of that Catholic bishop's hat. Bale, a little bit down, isn't what I thought it was. It's archaic. Use of the word is the definition is torment, a fierce, all the fierce bale.
This is bringing to mind the contemporary Q, as in the letter Q, conspiracy theory phenomena, which is
tied to Trump. Anyone need that defined?
The QAnon thing?
QAnon, yeah. Well, the studio of creative death, because QAnon, the idea is that there's a kind of global cabal of Satan worshiping pedophiles who, you know, in a way, like run the earth, like they're the sort of archons. But it's a mix of media, politics, finance, you know, power brokers, politics, and you know, you think of that nexus of Hollywood and the creative studio, the studio of creative death, and the drama of the earth, the tragic stage. I thought it was interesting. I've partly too because I read a reading recently of that Q, which is interpreted on mythological level. Like, what is this? If we were just to take this narrative for what it could be saying symbolically about our times, without necessarily taking it literally, although there are, I think, probably good arguments for taking it literally in some respects. You know, connected to figures like Epstein and actual known pedophile networks. So you know, connected to the highest levels of earthly power, you know, from monarchic to corporate, etc. Anyway, that just came to mind here, and of course, and that's, I think, part of the brilliance of this text is that it's like a prism that, you know, allows us to see many different facets, you know, that are not necessarily just fixated in the linear time when this was written. Do you hear a dog barking?
Yes.
Okay. That's Mojo.
Mojo, good name for a dog. Mojo's rising.
Mojo, yeah, definitely a son of darkness, this dog. Shall I continue?
I have one other thing to say about this section. This part of it on page 226 reminds me of the Black Mass. So when I was deeply involved in Catholicism, there was a story about the Black Mass, which was like a perversion of it of the Catholic Mass in every way. Just reading this, it reminds me of it. And I never read an authentic or a authoritative account of that. I think it was involved with Satan worship and black magic, wizardry, black magic. So I don't know really the historicity of it, but I think that was at least an old story that's been around for a long time. That is kind of similar to this part of the the chalice and the foaming chalice and sacramental wine and all that kind of thing.
Could we go over this next to last line, a couple lines after the semicolon? For even the radiant children of the gods to darken their privileges and dreadful right. I don't get quite the grammar of that.
These powers have the radiant have the privilege of darkening the radiant children of the gods. They have that privilege and their and that right to darken them.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, it sounds like the radiant children of the gods is the subject, but it's the object of the verb, the participle to darken.
Mm-hmm. And to be just slightly preemptive, this to the traveler of the worlds, that's Ashwapati directly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. So it's the sons of darkness is actually the subject of that. The doing the darkening of the privilege.
Yes.
Of the children of the gods. Okay. Interesting. Shall I? All right. This too, the traveler of the worlds must dare. A warrior in the dateless duel's strife, he entered into dumb, despairing night, challenging the darkness with his luminous soul. Alarming with his steps the threshold gloom, he came into a fierce and dolorous realm, peopled by souls who never had tasted bliss. Ignorant, like men born blind who know not light, they could equate worst ill with highest good. Virtue was to their eyes a face of sin, and evil and misery were their natural state. A dire administration's penal code, making of grief and pain the common law, decreeing universal joylessness, had changed life into a stoic sacrament and torture into a daily festival. An act was passed to chastise happiness. Laughter and pleasure were banned as deadly sins. A questionless mind was ranked as wise content. A dull heart's silent apathy as peace. Sleep was not there. Torpor was the sole rest. Death came, but neither respite gave nor end. Always the soul lived on and suffered more. Ever he deeper probed that kingdom of pain. Around him grew the terror of a world of agony followed by worse agony, and in the terror a great wicked joy, glad of one's own and others' calamity.
Their thought and life were a long punishment, the breath a burden, and all hope a scourge, the body a field of torment, amassed unease. Repose was a waiting between pang and pang. This was the law of things none dreamed to change. A hard, somber heart, a harsh, unsmiling mind, rejected happiness like a cloying sweet. Tranquility was a tedium and ennui. Only by suffering, life grew colorful. It needed the spice of pain, the salt of tears. If one could cease to be, all would be well. Else only fierce sensations gave some zest. A fury of jealousy burning the gnawed heart, the sting of murderous spite and hate and lust, the whisper that lures to the pit and treachery's stroke through vivid spots on the dull aching hours. To watch the drama of infelicity, the writhing of creatures under the harrow of doom and sorrow's tragic gaze into the night and horror and the hammering heart of fear were the ingredients in time's heavy cup that pleased and helped to enjoy its bitter taste. Of such fierce stuff was made up life's long hell. These were the threads of the dark spider's web in which the soul was caught, quivering and wrapped. This was religion. This was nature's rule. In a fell chapel of iniquity, to worship a black, pitiless image of power, kneeling, one must cross hard-hearted, stony courts, a pavement like a floor of evil fate. Each stone was a keen edge of ruthless force and glued with the chilled blood from tortured breasts. The dry, gnarled trees stood up like dying men, stiffened into a pose of agony. And from each window peered an ominous priest chanting Te Deums for slaughter's crowning grace, uprooted cities, blasted human homes. Burned, writhen bodies, the bombshells massacre.
Our enemies are fallen, they sang. All who once stayed our will are smitten and dead. How great we are, how merciful art thou. Thus thought they, to reach God's impassive throne and him command whom all their acts opposed, magnifying their deeds to touch his skies and make him an accomplice of their crimes. There, no relenting pity could have place, but ruthless strength and iron moods had sway, a dateless sovereignty of terror and gloom. This took the figure of a darkened god, revered by the racked wretchedness he had made, who held in a thrall a miserable world and helpless hearts nailed to unceasing woe, adored the feet that trampled them into mire. It was a world of sorrow and of hate, sorrow with hatred for its lonely joy, hatred with others' sorrow as its feast, a bitter rictus curled the suffering mouth. A tragic cruelty saw its ominous chance. Hate was the black archangel of that realm. It glowed, a somber jewel in the heart, burning the soul with its malignant rays and wallowed in its fell abysm of might. These passions, even objects seemed to exude, for mind overflowed into the inanimate world that answered with the wickedness it received. Against their users, used malignant powers, hurt without hands, and strangely, suddenly slew, appointed as instruments of an unseen doom. Or they made themselves a fateful prison wall where men condemned wake through the creeping hours counted by the toilings of an ominous bell. An evil environment worsened evil souls. All things were conscious there and all perverse. In this infernal realm, he dared to press even into the deepest pit and darkest core, perturbed its tenebrous base, dared to contest its ancient privileged right and absolute force. In night, he plunged to know her dreadful heart. In hell, he sought the root and cause of hell.
Its anguished gulfs opened in his own breast. He listened to clamors of its crowded pain, the heartbeats of its fatal loneliness. Above was a chill, deaf eternity. In vague, tremendous passages of doom, he heard the goblin voice that guides to slay, and faced the enchantments of the demon sign, and traversed the ambush of the opponent snake. In menacing tracts, in tortured solitudes, companionless, he roamed through desolate ways, where the red wolf waits by the fordless stream, and death's black eagles scream to the precipice, and met the hounds of Baal who hunt men's hearts, baying across the veldt of destiny, in fruitless battlefields of the abyss, fought shadowy combats in mute, eyeless depths, assaults of hell endured, and tightened strokes, and bore the fierce inner wounds that are slow to heal. A prisoner of a hooded magic force, captured and trailed in falsehood's lethal net, and often strangled in the noose of grief, or cast in the grim morass of swallowing doubt, or shut into pits of error and despair, he drank her poison draughts till none was left. In a world where neither hope nor joy could come, the ordeal he suffered of evil's absolute reign, yet kept intact his spirit's radiant truth. Incapable of motion or of force, in matter's blank denial, jailed and blind, pinned to the black inertia of our base, he treasured between his hands his flickering soul. His being ventured into mindless void, intolerant gulfs that knew not thought nor sense. Thought ceased, sense failed, his soul still saw and knew.
In atomic parcelings of the infinite, near to the dumb beginnings of lost self, he felt the curious small futility of the creation of material things, or stifled in the unconscious hollow dusk, he sounded the mystery dark and bottomless of the enormous and unmeaning deeps whence struggling life in a dead universe rose. There in the stark identity lost by mind, he felt the sealed sense of the insensible world and a mute wisdom in the unknowing night. Into the abysmal secrecy he came, where darkness peers from her mattress gray and nude, and stood on the last locked subconscious floor, where being slept unconscious of its thoughts, and built the world not knowing what it built. There, waiting its hour, the future lay unknown. There is the record of the vanished stars. There, in the slumber of the cosmic will, he saw the secret key of nature's change. A light was with him. An invisible hand was laid upon the error and the pain, till it became a quivering ecstasy, the shock of sweetness of an arm's embrace. He saw in night the eternal's shadowy veil, knew death for a cellar of the house of life. In destruction felt creation's hasty pace, knew loss as the price of a celestial gain, and hell as a shortcut to heaven's gates. Then in illusion's occult factory and in the inconscience magic printing house, torn were the formats of the primal night and shattered the stereotypes of ignorance. Alive, breathing a deep spiritual breath, nature expunged her stiff mechanical code and the articles of the bound soul's contract. Falsehood gave back to truth her tortured shape.
Annulled were the tables of the law of pain, and in their place grew luminous characters. The skillful penman's unseen finger wrote his swift, intuitive calligraphy. Earth's forms were made his divine documents. The wisdom embodied mind could not reveal. In conscience chased from the world's voiceless breast. Transfigured were the fixed schemas of reasoning thought. Arousing consciousness in things inert, he imposed dark atom and a dumb mass, the diamond script of the imperishable, inscribed on the dim heart of fallen things, a paean song of the free infinite, and the name, foundation of eternity, and traced on the awake exultant cells in the ideographs of the ineffable, the lyric of the love that waits through time, and the mystic volume of the book of bliss, and the message of the superconscient fire. Then life beat pure in the corporeal frame. The infernal gleam died and could slay no more. Hell split across its huge abrupt facade as if a magic building were undone. Night opened and vanished like a gulf of dream. Into being's gap, scooped out as empty space in which she had filled the place of absent God, there poured a wide, intimate, and blissful dawn. Healed were all things that time's torn heart had made, and sorrow could live no more in nature's breast. Division ceased to be, for God was there. The soul lit the conscious body with its ray. Matter and spirit mingled and were one. Thank God. We made it.
So I kind of would like to, all of a sudden, everything has changed. I would kind of like to go back to what happened. Where did all of a sudden God come back in, you know?
About
I think it's because,
a light was with him. The invisible hand was laid upon the air in pain. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a secret key of nature's change as well.
Yes.
Right.
It's the same thing I always want to do when I read this canto, Andrea. So what happened there now? And how did that happen?
It is all over. He drank her poison drafts till none was left. Wow.
Yeah.
To me, it seems like he went in as far as he went in all the way into this, but stayed present. It seems like that's kind of a summary way to say what he was doing. He just stayed present.
Before the light was with him, so where darkness peers from her mattress, gray and nude.
Where are you?
Darkness seemed very vulnerable and fragile compared to the earlier darkness which dominated. You know, so it's kind of preparing the way.
At the top of that page, it says, thought ceased, sense failed, his soul saw and knew. So it's again, it's kind of like this glance or this look that persists or.
Mm-hmm. There's also touch. I mean, what sets it off is that touch, the invisible hand, like a laying on of hands, laid upon the error and the pain, which, and that is the light as well.
And that lovely line, the shock of sweetness of an arm's embrace. It's like all of a sudden, there's love.
It seems like what happens is he sees the darkness, and then he has because he stayed there, there's this reversal that happens through his sight and the touch, the shock of sweetness of an arm's embrace, that seems like that brings in the heart. So it's not just a white light. It's also this other aspect.
It feels like a perfect description of what we each need to do individually with our own hidden pain and darkness, you know, to mm-hmm. go there and until we have it fully known and embraced, you know, and then it can shift.
Mm-hmm.
We can bring it into love. All the parts of us that have been outcast.
You mean to say I can't just sweep it under the carpet, Andrea?
Never works.
Sorry.
On the contrary, Matteo, you can if you want to, as long as you want.
You get the three-headed snake. She'll come and bite you.
So the skillful penman's unseen finger wrote his swift, intuitive calligraphy, shades of cayenne again.
Oh, shades of cayenne. Interesting. Has anyone read Douglas Copeland's Player One? Not to be confused with Ready Player One, but Douglas Copeland's Player One. He has a character that's encouraging people to write sacred things on every object. And it's a really powerful thing that I link in with that. What do you see? You see the rubaiyat in here?
Yeah, well, the unseen finger moved on. Mm-hmm. So that's track from the rubaiyat. So.
Ah, I would almost bet that Sri Aurobindo was a fan of the Rubaiyat. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right. A lover of
poetry from 100 years ago must have been.
I got an image of Dune from He Drank Her Poison Draughts Until None Was Left.
From Dune?
Dune, you know, Frank Herbert's series, Dune. And I've long wondered what the red wolf is a symbol of.
I thought the Nazis when I read that.
What line, more or less?
It's the middle of 230, of page 230.
A
little bit above the middle.
Because the black eagles, those sound like the Nazi symbols to me.
It was the SS, yeah.
Yeah.
The SS, okay. There's also Lord of the Rings, the Nazgul.
Yeah, that's who I thought of with the black eagles.
What year did Tolkien write that trilogy?
So he was writing in the war.
Ah.
It wasn't published until 56.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Or a little bit before.
Okay. Was he in England in the war or South Africa?
Well, he was in the First World War in the trenches.
Wow, didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh. Huh. Yeah, this word Velts feels very South African, Rhodesian. Yeah,
it's a Dutch word. Velt. Yeah. Field.
Yeah. Field. Ah, thank you. It's a Dutch word. Yeah, I guess I've heard it from those authors that are down there. Yeah. That have the Afrikaner Dutch base.
So that would be like the Boer War, I guess, referenced. Maybe as well.
Wow.
There's a thread of a kind of bureaucracy, like language here. These.
What page?
Well, it comes with the annulled tables of the law of pain. And that's, and then previous to that, and then there's the documents, the divine documents that are, I thought echoing that same kind of language, and I have to go back because it came up a little bit earlier. I was also at the motor vehicles myself earlier today dealing with other kinds of documents. Oh yeah, the Dyer administration's penal code, this is on 227, making of grief and pain the common law, decreeing a universal joylessness, has changed life into a stoic sacrament and torture into a daily festival. You know, this sort of bureaucratization of life, I think, is...
it actually reminds me in Holland. Mm-hmm. In Holland, you have the Calvinists, that you can't dance, you can't sing. It's like what you have now in the Middle East, you know, the whole fanatic trying to control the life force of people, the natural joy. You can't be joyful, you can't sing, you can't dance, you can't show your legs, everything has to be controlled, you know, dark. And it was Christian, and there is Islam. It's like the once they get the control going.
Although Islam's been doing it for 1,000 years, that kind of argument. Because I've been reading the documents in 11th century Persia, and you hear the same things there. So,
what do you mean, controlling the vital instincts?
Yeah, the sort of dancing and things like that, or I mean, it was a bit of a mixed culture. I mean, there were those things going on. And then you had the religious imams who were trying to put it down or you know, treat it as sinful or bad in some sense. So, you know, but so that, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we've been out of that for a long time.
That's how Khayyam got into so much trouble with the Muslims, even though he was a devout Muslim, because he talked about the joy of life and not just the
spirit. Why are people so afraid of joy? What is this?
My immediate answer is jealousy, but I don't know if that just came right to my mind as soon as you asked that question. That fear of joy is sometimes a deep jealousy, and yeah. Or like, why are people so afraid of freedom and free spirits? Why are people so afraid of free spirits? There's this deep jealousy around that. The captive soul and the captive mind hates to come in contact with a freed mind.
Can't be controlled either. And I think in a lot of times these puritanical kind of very usually patriarchal codes, they come with a kind of moral panic, you know, which is just predicating the decadence or the demise of the culture and you know, trying to make people feel afraid, to feel anything but afraid, to feel anything but fear, and therefore to be, you know, controlled within the system that, you know, those particular men are at the head of at that time. But you also see it from non-moral, from totally amoral places. Like, I think, like in contemporary political terms, you know, the conservative tendency to paint everything as, you know, things going to hell, and therefore you need us to come and bring law and order, is, I think, the same impulse. And, you know, Trump's hitting that drum again and again, because stirring up those kinds of emotions is what, you know, allows him to offer the, he has the product for that, you know, he has the solution for that he can then sell.
Yeah. I'll scare you to death and I'll come and save you.
Yeah, exactly.
The inner cities are, the suburbs are you know, going down. Okay.
Going down.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the best protest is just, you know, joy. You know, joy is the best way to counter that and say, well, actually, no, things are great. You know, and to, you know, to live well and to spread joy is really the answer. And then the tyrant looks like a fool and looks just silly and childish for, you know, trying
the
to make
has no pose.
I was hoping in the last debate Biden would have told that knock knock joke, knock knock, who's there, impatient, interrupting cow who, moo. I was hoping Biden would go there.
If only the Democrats got a sense of humor. Yeah. You know, we might get out of this mess, because
we might see it tonight with Kamala, who knows?
I hope so.
I hope she brings some joy to the damn thing.
She has roots to Pondicherry. I mean, I don't know if anyone's made direct connections, but her grandfather, you know, she's from Chennai, which is really not far from, the mother's side is from Chennai, which is not far from Pondicherry. It's as close. And there's like, Chennai is filled with Sri Aurobindo and mother devotees, disciples. Yeah. The connection could very well be there, actually, with Sri Aurobindo and Kamala Harris in some sort, in some way. I really love this tribal, this patriotic godhead tribal invocation of invoking What did our enemies are fallen? Are fallen? They sang. Thus thought the. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's also right out of the Old Testament too. I
think. Mm-hmm.
It's out of the Middle Ages. The Te Deum was the song that the Christian armies sang, and especially in victory. But it's a Latin song. But,
what is Deum Dei? What is
God? Deum means God.
What does Te mean?
I don't remember.
I don't remember. Okay.
I think it is you. I think it is an offering.
Oh, like you God. Oh my goodness, I have it written down here. You, comma God. Yeah, I must have looked it up. I didn't see it there.
I think it's the.
And of course, all the warriors were always blessed, you know, by the priests and all that crazy stuff.
Yeah, making him an accomplice of their crimes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure, Aurobindo's not. He doesn't shrink back from talking about religious figures and practices as perverted. You know? And they often have been. Mm-hmm. He often talks about the mitred individual. You know, the mitre is the bishop's hat.
Also the name of the style of locks, like the Panama Canal, the old canal, those locks that are shaped like this and have water pressure coming from the back to hold them shut. Da Vinci invented them, the mitered lock.
Because I just thought mitre was an angled shape used in construction.
That's it. And so the Pope hat or the bishop hat
the
is
the Pope hat has the same shape. Mm-hmm. And the locks have the same shape. So I'm not sure which came first, whether I don't think the Pope's hat was the first, but I may be wrong.
Oh,
probably.
The shape became the definition.
Yeah.
Does anyone have a definition for rictus? I could look at a bit of rictus curled.
Gaping. Or a kind of
gaping.
Yeah, big, like a expression on the face, a distorted expression on the face. But
a kind of like fixed, aghast smile.
Yeah, some rigidity.
But it sounds like a political smile, a scripted political smile that's, now I know I need to look aghast. Something like that.
A fixed grimace or grin, it says.
Mm.
It's a terrible word. It sounds really terrible. A rictus. It sounds like rectum.
Yeah, I was going to say it sounds like.
It's like having. Yeah.
we almost. Yeah, we went there. Yeah, it sounds like a real personal medical problem. Yeah, and I sense this canto as really a prelude to book 10, the book where Savitri is battling with death. Except he's like, I don't feel his wife here. I don't feel the queen here. I really don't feel this, the queen come in until the book of fate. I feel him alone doing this yoga, sitting still and experiencing all of this in his field. And then the key difference between this yoga and Savitri's yoga is Savitri's is happening through the bond of love with Satyavan. So there's this circuitry with death. There's a circuitry with death and Satyavan and Savitri later on. that I haven't quite been able to sense here. It just seems more like Ashwapati witnessing rather than in this love circuitry where Savitri's doing the battle because of this deep, deep love for Satyavan and for the earth and for humanity. So it's not like that doesn't exist with Ashwapati here, but I don't feel that deep love current that I do in book 10 and like the raison d'etre of Savitri going through this for Ashwapati. The raison d'etre is in this is for the to get to the divine mother to ask for the birth of Savitri. Yeah, world's desire compelled her mortal birth, going back to that first line of the Yoga of the King, the first Yoga of the King.
So I have to get going. I have a meeting on the hour that I'm not looking forward to, but I have to sit in on, so.
Good luck with that. Sorry, Jeffries. Do you have time to end with a couple minute meditation?
Yeah, I do.
Everybody, okay. Everyone good? Lovely session, everyone. Thank you.
Oh, really? A lot happening.
Yeah. Okay. Do you like the time of meditation for us? Thanks, Andrea. Hope you feel better, Jeffrey.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Everybody.
Bye-bye.
For the session, it was great.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Andrea? I'd love to, Andrea?
Yeah.
I'd love to have that tea sometime, go for a walk. Yeah?
Yeah, please. Could
your place or mine?
Well, I'd love to walk in the woods. That'd be great.
Oh yeah, yeah. I know a number of amazing walks around here. Let me look at my calendar really quick here.
So the one thing that is neat, I can't do much up and down.
Okay.
Fall Creek was my favorite, but I don't dare go down that incline anymore.
Okay.
At the beginning.
I have an idea. Take you to a really special place that's basically skirts through an amazing, beautiful spot. You'll see the fire line. You'll smell char, if that's okay with you. It's beautiful.
Fine with me, yeah.
It goes to this place that's the heart of the forest, and it's a super steep walk up, like ridiculous. So we'll drive up there, and it's super short drive.
We can drive up.
Yeah, we can drive up and park. But let me have
you
a quick
look at your calendar.
Yeah. It can't be. So I'm looking. Yeah, it could be Friday at tea time, like 3:30 or something. How's that sound?
That sounds good.
Three is better. It'd be good if I'm freed up by about 5. Yeah, okay, Friday at 3.
And I'll just come to your house.
Uh-huh, yeah, yeah.
I'll just come to your house.
Good, yeah. Good.
I'm so sorry you don't have your dogs anymore.
Oh my God, yeah. It's been a process.
It's a huge change.
Huge, huge.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. And then Tammy just left. Thank goodness she can take the responsibility for Gideon, because now I can go to Panama without needing to come home. There's really some blessings in it for sure. Yeah. Yeah. But then euthanizing Magis and burying him. Oh my goodness. It's been quite a process. There's just something about really pure dog love, that protection, and yeah, there's just something about that communion that is precious and so hard to do. Oh. But
did you bury him on your lamp?
I'll send you a photo. I'll send you a photo. We made a really sweet thing for him. Yeah. Yeah, I'll send you a photo.
Yes, do, please.
Yeah. Great, yeah, Andrea. Yeah. I'll see you Friday at 3. I'll put it on my calendar. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Glad you caught me.
Yeah. Good.
Bye, honey.